We are in a somewhat less than favorable position right at the opening of the quarter, only because we're doing a different set of material here in lab than we are in lecture. So in lecture, obviously, we're in the land of carboxylic acids and derivatives. Here, we're going to start studying what could be broadly described as alpha chemistry, the chemistry of hydrogens attached at the alpha position relative to a carbonyl. And this first reaction that we're going to learn involving alpha chemistry is the aldol condensation. So before we get to the condensation itself or about alpha chemistry, you need to know what an alpha position is, which some of you might know that from previous classes or the text. I might have even mentioned the phrase once or twice last quarter, but not that much because we weren't worried about things next to the carbonyl. We were just too busy describing how the carbonyl itself reacts. But if we wanted to use the common name terms for the positions going away from that carbonyl, the closest one is called the alpha position. And that's because alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet. Beta position would be the next one for the next letter, then gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, iota, kappa, lambda, mu, z, you know, so on and so forth. Of course, most of those letters most people don't know. You know the smattering that you know from physics and math, and hopefully you know these first four, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. But sometimes the very last letter, omega, is used because it's the last letter of the alphabet. And instead of counting exactly how many carbons there are, if you just want to refer to the end of the chain, you could say a phrase like, oh, well, that omega hydroxy acid. Omega hydroxy acid would mean start with a carboxylic acid at one end and at the very other end put a hydroxy group. Well, we're going to focus just on that alpha position, which we've seen used before. In fact, you haven't seen the direction of reaction I'm about to show you. You've seen its reverse. Because imagine we took an aldehyde and we threw a base like sodium hydroxide at it. Even more generally, let's just say strong base. Let's not get hung up about the type of base doing this. If it attacks the carbonyl, what functional group could we, in theory, be trying to produce? If the hydroxide attacks the carbonyl directly, then we'd have one OH group on that carbonyl, wouldn't we? And we have the other oxygen left over that, if it got protonated, what would it become? A hydrate, right? Because we've added water across the carbonyl. In other words, I'm saying that if the carbonyl were attacked, we'd end up with something like this, which is just short one hydrogen from being a hydrate. Are hydrates normally thermodynamically favorable? My goodness, we did hydrates last quarter when we talked about PCC and primary alcohols versus secondary. That's when we talked about hydrates. I guess the fine details are starting to recede into time. No, they're not normally isolatable. That's why normally we're not worried about them. And in fact, thinking back to the final from last quarter, there was even a problem that synthesis-wise or mechanism-wise said product must be isolatable, addressing the issue that hydrates normally can't be isolated. On top of the fact they're normally not thermodynamically favorable, we can't even fully make the hydrate, because notice that H plus there. That means we'd have to exit basic conditions in order to be able to produce the hydrate. So it's just not going to happen. What other thing besides making a hydrate could happen then? That's what I'm really trying to get at. Well, You notice I have another hydrogen that's been written here. And you might recall that I did get confused between the three sections. Boy, when has that happened before? On Friday during lecture, where I started getting on your cases about pKa values that you hadn't yet even seen. So then it wasn't quite right for me to get on your case if I hadn't even given you the info yet, right? Even I have to admit that. But I gave you that info, so what is the pKa of that hydrogen? No, I just asked that an hour ago and I got the right answer. 16. For an aldehyde, the average is 16. For a ketone, it's 19. But wait a minute. Isn't 16 pretty low? What's an alkane's average pKa? 6.0, 6D, not 16. Huge difference in acidity then, right? Why? What's so special that that proton is all of a sudden so much more acidic? Well, induction, partly, yes, but it's more than just that. Resonance from what? What if that hydrogen did come off? A base pulls off that hydrogen. Depending on the base used, that removal is reversible. I put a reversible arrow here because that matches the way I presented it in the other classes. But you being the third class I presented to, I'm learning there's some subtle details I need to weave into this discussion. So whether or not that is reversible depends on how strong the starting base was. If the starting base was similar in basicity to this thing that we just produced, in other words, if we used hydroxide that had a pKa also about 16, well, then that means the base strength of what you produced and what you started with are about the same, which means the reaction easily could float back and forth. If we used a Grignard reagent right here, of course we wouldn't use a Grignard reagent because it would attack the carbonyl, but if we use something basic like a Grignard reagent, then it would deprotonate and have no chance of going in reverse. And I don't want to keep showing you these mechanistic details to confuse you. In this case, it's to get you ready for this question that will come up later. When is a basic reaction reversible? When is it irreversible? Because last quarter and the quarter before, I programmed you to say, oh, basic reaction, irreversible. Ooh, acidic reaction, that means it's going to be catalyzed and multi-step and a bunch of arrows going everywhere, multi-step reaction. Basic reactions can be reversible, and you hadn't seen it before because this is the first quarter where we're going to have products or reactants that are similar in strength. So, I'm writing this as a reversible arrow. For today's lab, it really is a reversible arrow. Just recognize there'll be times that it's a forward arrow only, and there'll be a darn good reason for it. So, once I've made this amide, we need to acknowledge the fact that, yes, as Leonardi was trying to point out, it is delocalized. And even more than induction, that delocalization is what provides enough stabilization to this anion that that's why that position is so acidic to begin with. Because anything that stabilizes the product makes the product easier to form, means the reactant's more reactable. Since we're quantifying that in terms of an acid dissociation, if the anion, the base, is more stable, the acid is more acidic. So lower pKa. If I put a hydrogen on this product, what functional group would that be called? Enol. But it is not an enol because it doesn't have the hydrogen. It's the conjugate ion, which is called enolate, using the common ate ending for a negative ion. And of course, this is all occurring under basic conditions. And we encountered this in the opposite direction when we tried to do hydroboration of alkynes. And I know this is a stretch to get you to remember all the way back then. But when we hydroborated an alkyne, we ended up with an enol. And enols are not thermodynamically stable. That's an enol formed under basic conditions, and so we saw this base conversion into a carbonyl. At some point, though, we also did it under acidic conditions, so I remember doing the acid version. Since we're approaching this from a different perspective, from the carbonyl's perspective, let me also show you that reaction mechanism under acidic conditions to get us to the same point. So if, for example, we had some strong acid source, then the first likely step of the reaction, as many of the carbonyl reactions are, for that carbonyl to become protonated. Once protonated, we could highlight its delocalized nature by writing a resonant structure. But if we didn't have water around, which even if it did, remember, forming hydrates is not favorable. So they'll form, but they'll unform as well. At some point, what if we had a base come along and pull off the hydrogen here? Well, we've now made an enol, which is unfavorable, but, and this is an idea that's going to come up a lot this quarter, if an equilibrium can happen, it will happen. I might have said that in a past class, but I'll say it again. It sounds good. If an equilibrium can happen, it will happen. What does that mean? If an equilibrium is balanced so that it heavily favors reactants, that still means a little product has to form. Otherwise, you can't have equilibrium. So even enols are unfavorable to form. In traces, they will form. And the point that we're learning this quarter is then they'll react. So alpha positions actually do a whole sequence of extremely useful reactions. Carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions. You might think, well, why didn't we learn all this last quarter? Well, on top of everything we already learned last quarter, so it's something done purposefully when teaching organic chemistry, that we get all worried about the carbonyl, and later on we go back and say, oh, by the way, there's this position next to the carbonyl that you also have to worry about. Which this is the only taste of it we've gotten so far, and in fact, what is this called? These two little portions of reaction mechanisms. We've had a name for it before. Not condensation, but good guess, because that's what today's lab is. Tautomerization. This is one specifically called the keto-enol tautomerization. Okay, yes, I happen to use aldehydes as my example materials. They're not ketones. But you can also understand it doesn't make sense to have two names for the same reaction mechanism. So, defaulted to ketone, so keto-enol tautomerization, which is how we make enols and enolates to do these condensation reactions. So let's see an example of an alpha reaction, the aldol condensation. Why is it called an aldol condensation? Because if you're doing a real, true, honest to goodness, pure aldol condensation, you're only starting with aldehydes as starting materials. And unless you use strong enough conditions to cause a secondary reaction, the product is going to be an alcohol. So aldehyde making an alcohol, aldol. How does reaction start? Normally under basic conditions. And when we When we get to the same topic again in lecture, I'll talk more about the base that we should or shouldn't use to start the reaction off. For now, since today's lab uses hydroxide, I'm also going to use hydroxide here, which works because water's pKa is 15.7 and aldehyde's pKa is roughly 16. That means that aldehyde is slightly less basic, but only that much less basic, acidic than water is. That means hydroxide is just about the same strength, but just barely short of the same strength of base once we deprotonate that aldehyde. Reason I'm building all that up is because you use a concentrated solution of hydroxide, 50% weight solution, I think it is. And you need something concentrated like that to force the deprotonation fully to occur. Mechanism-wise, we'll draw it like this. Deprotonate that position. Because hydroxide's comparable in base strength, it's going to be a reversible process. So that's why I'm using a reversible arrow. It is optional to do the next part. I'll write it out once, because one of the other sections I just referred to it, but afterwards I got worried that too much if I say and don't write, it's not going to be caught. So I'll write it once, but highlight that this is optional, what I'm about to do, to show the delocalization. Why is it optional to show the delocalization? Because delocalization happens regardless of how we write it. Remember, I've said it a zillion times over the past year. Our writing system's inadequate for delocalized systems. So writing the delocalization is just given more evidence of our poor writing system, not really illustrating anything useful chemically. I guess when learning about this topic, writing the structure might be useful to emphasize the fact that it is an enol type system. So this here we can see the double bond on carbon. I guess that's why that matters. If you wrote it delocalized like that, you'd show it collapsing straight away again. And I guess the next time I write this mechanism, I'll write it without this, so you can see the shorter way to do it. But what's going to happen next, regardless of how we write it? Well, negatively charged carbon, which is what we've effectively generated, is nucleophilic. Negative charge on carbon would be even more likely to substitute than if you had a negative charge on oxygen. So it attacks that carbonyl of another molecule and pushes that carbonyl open. What do we get as a result? Well, the compound that had formed the enolate, that carbonyl is going to reform again. So one molecule retains its carbonyl in this reaction. The other molecule clearly, though, just got attacked. Of course, we also now have a new carbon-carbon bond. That's one of the most important aspects of this reaction synthetically, that we're able to make new carbon-carbon bonds. So notice that I said a new carbon-carbon bond is formed at the alpha and beta positions relative to the enolate's carbonyl. Again, the one that actually survives the condensation reaction. Question came up this morning, wait, which beta? How do we know which one is beta? And let me show you why they're asking it in that way. Because relative to carbonyl, there is only one alpha position. But there are two beta positions. Nothing wrong with that. It doesn't mean I can't still call one of them the beta position and say the bond formed there. So it's not that you have to identify the most important chain and that's called beta on that chain. No. It just means two positions away from the carbonyl. Why am I so worked up about this alpha-beta bond forming? Because you've got five other condensation reactions you're going to learn once we switch to this chapter. And you need to recognize when one versus the other happens. Some of those reactions involve aldehydes and ketones, like this condensation. Some of those involve esters and carboxylic acids, which is why we normally don't get to this topic until after we finish carboxylic acids. But knowing that this is where it drives people crazy, this topic material, is which one of these condensations is happening. Here's the way to recognize it. Alpha, beta bond, and a new functional group at the beta position. Right now it's just an alkoxide. As soon as we allow the next part of the mechanism to occur, it's an alcohol. Very common byproduct is to dehydrate that alcohol. So you might end up with a double bond, but it will always, 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 in one of these condensations be something that includes that beta position. So the beta position is key in this into recognizing this kind of condensation. Now, that's a long side story. I had never finished the mechanism, so let me go back and finish that. Obviously, it's likely the alkoxide's going to be neutralized. The not-so-obvious thing is that we're in basic solution, which means we can't show H+. You know, so many times we just say H+ when we want a proton, not when you got concentrated hydroxide around. So you have to show water being attacked, which if we used hydroxide as the base, then once it did pull a proton off, we made water. So even in a purely organic mixture, there's going to be a little water around. So that will allow us to protonate the alkoxide. But as I said a moment ago, there are situations where that's not the end of the story. Because if an alpha proton is acidic once, is there anything to stop it from being acidic again? No. In fact, we're going to learn soon, when we do get to alpha reactions, there'll be certain situations where do a reaction once, and the next one's even easier. And then the next one's even easier after that. In other words, we're going to learn how we can increase the acidity of that alpha proton by doing an alpha reaction. For the moment, it's good enough to say it will react again. But this time, before it has a chance to condense again, there's an intramolecular process that can occur. It kicks off hydroxide as a leaving group. I'll say that again. It kicks off hydroxide as a leaving group. How many times have we seen hydroxide be a leaving group in this class? Now two. When was the other time? The hydroboration reaction. Did you listen to the other section? You just remembered that. Well, that's good. But because it's correct. If you remember way back when we did borane, first, the borane reacts, you make that trialkyl borane derivative. Hydrogen peroxide attacks, and an alkyl shift, an unusual alkyl shift occurs. It occurs by kicking hydroxide off, the only other time. Why would that be even favorable to occur in this case? Well, because you make an unsaturated product, a conjugated unsaturated product. an alpha beta unsaturated carbonyl containing compound. Another telltale sign of an aldol condensation. Now, key bit of mechanism here, and I'm not trying to pick on you personally, you unfortunately are one of the people I remember did this on one test or quiz somewhere last quarter, which is trying to save space by putting multiple mechanism steps together on paper. And the only reason I'm pointing this out is because kinetically, you might try to condense a mechanism on paper to make it take up less space, but it might be not how a reaction occurs. This deprotonation is a separate step from the elimination. It would be equivalent to E1, which I think I scared someone this morning when I started talking about it, but that's not going to stop me from doing it. If you remember what E1 reaction means, it means it's unimolecular, which means that only one molecule is involved in the rate-limiting step of that reaction. The elimination is intramolecular. It is only involving itself. So that would be a unimolecular process. E2 means bimolecular, means you have two molecules involved. And if you look at the step before, hydroxide pulling off the hydrogen, two molecules are involved. If both of these steps happen together, then the overall reaction would have two molecules in its rate-limiting step, and so it would also be bimolecular. But the fact that I have these written as separate steps must mean that in real life the reaction is only unimolecular, meaning the base is not involved in the rate-limiting step, meaning only the molecule itself is involved, which is why these are two separate steps. It is a flavor of E1, and I never used to teach this because it didn't used to be in the OChem textbooks, at least not this label. I believe it's called ECB1 or something like that. This will make, I know, the hyper-curious in here go find it so they could say, yeah, you're right, Dr. Gray, or you got it totally wrong, Dr. Gray. But it's a form of E1, meaning they're definitely separate steps. So you can't, what I'm trying to say here is don't write all this together or it's going to be marked wrong. Now, that's an aldol condensation. It's an ideal aldol condensation. Why is it ideal? Because only one product forms. And then we got just a little bit more to talk about, and then we'll be ready for lab. Yes?
So what is the condensation?
Condensation is this whole thing where you take one molecule, condense it, combine it with another one to make a larger molecule. That's condensation. Now, let's look at mixed aldols. Because you need to understand why is today's reaction an example of an ideal mixed aldol condensation. Because there's two very good concrete reasons for it. And you know, when there's such an important structural question like this that has a very concrete answer, that's the type of thing that makes a beautiful question for lab exams. As all these heads look up suddenly. So maybe I'll make that comment again. We need to figure out why is this lab an example of an ideal mixed aldol condensation. Of course, to know that, you need to know what a mixed aldol is. And it's when you use more than one type of compound. I have ethanol and propanol, two different aldehydes. I'm exposing to sodium hydroxide heat and time. So give it enough time to do whatever it's going to do. How many products am I going to get? 4. You're right. Why? Because either one of the starting materials can make the enolate. And then the enolate can attack either one of the starting materials. So propanol can condense with propanol. Propanol can condense with ethanol. Ethanol can condense with propanol, which is a different thing. And then ethanol can condense with itself. So in other words, we end up with these 4 products. Now, of course, you need to go back and prove to yourself these are the correct 4 products. That's a lecture exercise. Do that later. But you do need to be able to understand how I got those 4 things. So mixed aldol condensations in which more than one compound, and particularly when you have an aldehyde and a ketone involved, when you have more than one thing, you get a mess because you can potentially get 4 products. Now, I said that 4 products can result. And yet we're doing a lab where we have 2 different materials, but we're only going to get 1 main product. With any other byproducts in such a small proportion, it doesn't matter. Let's look at our reaction, and for dramatic effect, having mentioned the lab quiz, let's see why this is an ideal condensation. Is there anybody unaware of what one of the questions on the first lab quiz is going to be? What are our 2 materials for today? Acetophenone, which a phenone is a benzene stuck to a carbonyl. Acetophenone means the 2 compound object, or 2 carbon object connected to the benzene ring. So in other words, this. Our other reactive material is what? Which aldehyde is related to anisole, which, remember, is OCH3 attached to a benzene ring. So para-anisaldehyde will be putting an aldehyde at the para position to anisole. Now notice what I'm setting up here. This is an example of an ideal cross-aldol because how many of these compounds have alpha protons? How many of the compounds have alpha protons? 1. Yes? Is he right? Yeah, he is. Because the hydrogen on the carbonyl itself is not an alpha proton. There's no delocalization that would happen if you pull the carbonyl hydrogen off, so they're normally not reactive. The other end of this particular carbonyl, the one on perialdehyde, you have the benzene ring there, which benzene, each carbon in benzene only has one hydrogen to begin with. So if you've stuck something onto the benzene ring, it took up that hydrogen's position, so there's no alpha protons there. So only one of the two compounds has alpha protons, so only one enolate can form. That cuts in half the number of potential products right there. Once the enolate forms, what's it going to attack? Another carbonyl. Which of these two compounds is more reactive in terms of their carbonyl? The aldehyde. Because remember last quarter we discussed that ketones, by having two alkyl groups, automatically have more hyperconjugation between those alkyl groups and the carbonyl's pi bond. The hyperconjugation stabilizes the pi bond, which makes it less reactive. An aldehyde automatically lacks one of those alkyl groups. And because the hydrogen that is on an aldehyde is 90 degrees to the pi bond, there's no way it can stabilize that pi bond. Less stabilization means higher reactivity. Aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. Well, if we have an enolate that's going to attack one of these versus the other, it's going to attack the aldehyde. It's enough more reactive that it's the only thing that reacts. So because only one thing will make the enolate, and because only one molecule reacts with the enolate, that's why we get 99% or whatever high percentage of just one product, the one that we're making in lab today. Is all that banging coming from the floor or up above us? The floor, really? That's the way I felt it too. They're doing something today. I guess this is because this is one of only two locations I've been in when I've actually been through earthquakes. That's why when this room starts shaking, I get a little more nervous, maybe. So, shall we see the mechanism for this reaction then? Since those of you who are returning students know by now that any lab quiz, one of the automatic questions is the mechanism for the lab that you did. So, even if you don't want it, you should want it. This time, since I've already had that discussion about how you don't really need to show the delocalization, I'll do this the short way where I don't show it. So deprotonation. In this lab, it is a good thing that it is only the ketone that has alpha protons, because it's got a pKa of 19. Let me point that out on here. Which means hydroxide does not instantly deprotonate it. Hydroxide is a weaker base than that enolate. But it's the only thing that can form. And like I said a little earlier, if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. And so some of this will form, and then it will continue to react. We help make sure this happens by using the strong concentrated solution of hydroxide. So we form the enolate, which will now react with the para N-S aldehyde. Remember that the carbonyl that made the enolate remains intact. The carbonyl that got attacked, of course, is just gone. After the initial attack, the condensation itself, that alkoxide gets protonated, which, again, remember, we're in basic conditions. So we have to use water, not H+. That gets us a beta hydroxycarbonyl, and it turns out that it's not always when you have heat around that a second reaction happens, because, I mean, we'll talk very briefly about it, your procedure, you don't even heat the stuff up, do you? There's no heating in this lab, correct? If it didn't work, okay, but otherwise you're supposed to do this without any heating, correct? Even without the heat, the dehydration's going to happen. So hydroxide attacks. We make an enolate that doesn't condense again. And there might be steric reasons for that. But what happens instead is intramolecular elimination. And we've made our alpha beta unsaturated carbonyl containing compound. Now, a portion of this molecule, and I'm not sure where the name derives from, but other molecules with this structural feature are called chalcones. And so sometimes if you're trying to look up anything related to this lab in terms of mechanism or PKs or whatever, if you just had some curiosity and were hunting around, you can search for chalcone and you should find this lab or something very much like it. Now, let's very briefly talk about procedure. So this is what I would normally call a shake and bake reaction, except we don't even bake this time. As we commented on just a moment ago, it really is just a shake reaction. In fact, you throw everything together at once, hydroxide being last. Why? Because the hydroxide could potentially start forming an enolate with the acetophenone. And if you only had acetophenone, in theory, it condenses with itself. When we get to lecture, when you get to this topic in lecture properly, we'll find out that that condensation is often reversible. That's also part of the reason we're not worried about condensation products of ketones here. So that'll be one thing. Just had another procedure-related thing. Oh, yes, the hydroxide being last. We add the hydroxide last, so we avoid it condensing with itself, and to make sure if the enolate forms, it does have the aldehyde to then immediately react with. There we go. You may skip the recrystallization, because I know there were a bunch of reactions last quarter that people got crystals, beautiful crystals, then they'd come up and say, but I lost it all because I tried to recrystallize. So since we're a day behind in lab already, let's make our workload lighter so that we can get through this easily. Now, a couple of notes then. You're not really doing any form of purification this time, are you? Because the product forms as a solid and you're just vacuum filtering it. Which, yes, this morning, thankfully, the vacuum system worked. But we're not doing any drying agent, therefore, we're not doing any washes. So the only things you should be disposing of, I'm guessing, are your reaction mixtures, which, since they're organic mixtures, that essentially means you only have organic waste today, except for whatever leftover sodium hydroxide mixture you might have, which, of course, would then go into the basic waste. You want to make sure that your compounds are thoroughly dry before you try to do IR. So you have two choices if you do fly through the lab. You can either leave it in the oven, your product, for a few minutes to hopefully dehydrate it today, or we can do IR next time once you're sure that your products have dried. If you're storing materials in your drawer, a reminder that you need to have your name, the date, and the name of the compound that you're storing. But since you're storing a solid, it doesn't need to be in secondary containment. And in fact, I would encourage you to leave it open to atmosphere, because it's so, compared to other substances, non-toxic. It's not going to be harmful being left open, and you want it to dry out. Any questions? Yes. Currently, no. Any other questions? Let's get to work then.